Wherever you are in the world, thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Badminton Podcast, a community for badminton players by badminton players, proudly brought to you by Velan. We talk all things badminton and aim to inspire you to be better in your game and in life by celebrating the people and stories of our global badminton community, whether they be past or present professional players, social players, officials or fans.
We're your hosts, Jeff and Henry, and we love badminton. From the bottom of our hearts, we'd just like to say thank you to everyone who has listened to, shared, and been part of the podcast. It wouldn't be possible without you all. If you do enjoy our episodes and can spare just a couple of dollars each month, you can really help keep the podcast going by supporting us on Patreon. Just visit www.patreon.com/thebadmintonpodcast. We'll leave the link in the description.
Hey everyone, this is part one of a two-part series of our conversation with Leon Jake Lim. Enjoy. So today we have Leon Jake Lim joining us. He is an entrepreneur that runs his own badminton academy in Malaysia. He's also an investor, fund manager, and freelance analyst for a finance YouTube channel called FIRL, Finance in Real Life, which has 18,200 subscribers at the time of recording. If that wasn't enough, he also helps run his family business. He studied philosophy, politics, and economics at the University of London. And when he was younger, he studied Plato's philosophy in university, where Plato has said in the past, "He who is a scholar only is too soft, too effeminate. The ideal citizen is the scholar athlete, the man of thought, and the man of action." This resonated with his own intuitive understanding of what the ideal human being would be, always seeking to build both the mind and the body, and of course, the soul as well. This is also the reason why Leon joins us today, for listeners to hear about how philosophy has informed his passion for badminton and how the discipline of investing brings a contrast to it that brings balance for him.
Trying to find a balance between natural instinct and control. So if you have too much instinct, right, then you lack structure, right? You become very, he used the word unscientific. But let's say if you have too much control, then suddenly you become a mechanical man. You become like a robot. But if you marry those two together and you synthesize those two things, then you become a totally different monster, so to speak, you know? And that's where you someone can find growth, right? So of course, Bruce Lee and even Plato as well, they're talking about very similar concepts, right? Marrying two extremes together. So I think human beings in general do know this intuitively, that it is when you find balance in between one extreme that you find growth, right? Whilst if you're too much on one side, then you become too much of a lopsided character, you know, and no one wants to be a lopsided character if they realize it or not.
Welcome onto the podcast, Leon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the podcast. Also very honored. Because I think this podcast has also featured the likes of Lokin Yu and Tony Gunawan as well. So to be in the same podcast as these guys, definitely an honor. Thank you.
Peter Gator. just want to say Peter Gator as well.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks so much for coming onto the podcast. We might get started with talking a bit about badminton. Of course, this is the Badminton Podcast. So it'd be really great to hear about your badminton story, Leon. So if you wouldn't mind, tell us a bit about how you got started playing the sport.
Right. So I started playing badminton when I was maybe about 7 or 8, I think. So maybe just slightly a bit later for those who actually want to actually seek to go far in badminton. And I actually started playing badminton on the streets, you know, like almost like with that like little third row backwater picture, right? So that was literally how I started playing badminton, like on the streets, on the front of my neighbor's gate. So we used to live on a hill in Malaysia. So I would say on the periphery of KL, Kuala Lumpur, there's this place called Taman Melawati where I used to live. And I lived on this hill and then I would cycle down the hill and I would have a very good friend. And then they just put like a string across his gate, right? So they open the gate, right? So then you have the car porch and then they just put like a string over the width of the car porch. And then that was pretty much like the badminton net. And then that's how I started playing badminton on the street to my neighbors. So that's actually literally how I had my first foray into badminton. And then eventually I started to really like it. I think maybe a year or two later, my parents signed me up for training at Michael's Badminton Academy, actually. So it used to be a very big and famous badminton academy in Malaysia. I don't think it's around anymore, actually. So I started training Michael's Badminton Academy when I was maybe about 9. And then maybe, I think it was about a year later that I entered the school team at the age of 10. And so that's basically roughly how I started playing badminton. So, and I was very chubby when I was young as well. So I think my parents were very encouraging of me to play badminton.
Awesome. So you started off, look, 7 or 8 isn't that old, especially like in Australia.
Half the age that when I started.
It's very early for Henry. It's probably about when I started as well. Maybe about 8 is when I started. But yeah, I guess in Malaysia, you start as soon as you can hold a racket in your hand, right?
Yeah. I have a few students and they're only 4 years old.
Oh,
wow.
That's great. I wish I had 4 extra years when I was 8 years old. But so you started off in the school. So after you got into the school badminton team and maybe you lost a bit of weight because you were able to do more badminton, where did it grow after that?
Right. So after I was in the badminton team, in Malaysia, we have the circuit for players of the district level. It's called MSSD, right? So then I was playing around there and that circuit. So basically, our kids represent their school play in MSSD. So that's like the district level. So probably like the lowest tier level that you can play in competitively. And then after that, when I went to secondary school, I had a chance to compete in, I would say, state level tournaments. And I also trained with some state players as well throughout my secondary school, especially the earlier part. But then I was never really actually good enough to represent state. So yeah, because Malaysia is actually very competitive. And so when you're at the state level, you compete in MSSS. So that's the name of that circuit, right? And in order to represent my state, you got to actually train at least 5 times a week. So at that frequency, my parents weren't that encouraging. And I think they always preferred me to focus on my education as well. So, but of course, I'm not here to say like that was a restriction placed on me. But at the same time, I think for that age, I reached a level where I was sort of comfortable with, at the same time, like I wasn't really sacrificing my education. Because when you're training at that frequency, you will have to sacrifice your education, right? And so, but then, so I went to the UK when I was 17. And that was when I was actually sort of good enough to play county level, actually. So county is the equivalent of state in Malaysia. But of course, in England, I wouldn't say that the level is significantly lower, but just that the amount of players for the same level gets less and less as higher up as you go in England. And also maybe because like the funding and everything is not very high. So maybe not a lot of parents encourage their kids to play badminton, but maybe rather football instead. Yeah, so I played the national circuit when I was in UK. So I think I reached something like top 40 or top 30, something like that, ranking in England for men's doubles. I did manage to play tournaments around Europe as well. And then, that's pretty much the sort of the spectrum of my so-called semi-pro badminton career, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So I guess your progression was started from your MSSD and then to MSSS, if I'm correct. And there's a playing difference between the levels of county versus MSSS. So when you did go to the UK and you managed to be, I guess, within the top 40, how was that different compared to playing in Malaysia? Was there any sort of key differences you noticed about, say, the playing style or the overall mindset of the players between the two countries?
Yeah, there's a huge difference actually with the playing style in England and in Malaysia. So I think from my observation, Malaysian players are, in comparison to England, so maybe I'll start with the not so good ones. I think Malaysian players are in general, they're probably not as fit as the English players, actually. I do think the English players are very, very fit because the tournaments actually go on from like they start from like 8 a.m. and then sometimes they go on until almost midnight, you know. So I've seen players play like all three categories, you know, singles, doubles, and then mix as well. So it's quite amazing, like the sort of fitness that I've seen in England. But Malaysian players in general have a much more spectrum in terms of skill. I do think in general, they also understand the game much better as well. And I think, of course, all else being equal, because of course, people like to talk about like the conditions, like the shuttle speed, the temperature, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, in general, English players, okay, there's also a spectrum, right? You got like the county level, right? And then you got the junior national team and the national team. So when I was competing, I played against county players, ex-national players in England, junior national English national players. I also played against some ex-national players from all around the world as well, because when they come to study, right? So maybe they play the national team as well from their own respective countries. And yeah, I think it's very interesting to see like the difference between the styles of the two countries. So yeah, in general, Malaysian players, much more skillful. I do think they understand the game much better. English players are more like, okay, let's say we're talking about men's doubles, because maybe your listeners play more men's doubles than they play men's singles. So in men's doubles, English players at the county level, I would say they rely on their fitness and consistency a lot. So their range of shots, I would say in vocabulary, right, the range of shots that they play is actually very, very direct and very, very, yeah, they don't have a wide variation of shots basically. But Malaysian players for that equivalent are quite skillful, quite solid in the defense, and also quite solid attack. And I think Malaysian players in general, they choose much more wisely when they attack. And like for example, in men's doubles, like if you're at the back, a lot of the players our level prefer to play jobs first before really finding the chance then to smash. But in England, the county players tend to just go out, smash most, and then only jog when you only have to, that kind of thing. So that's the general difference in terms of style. But of course, when you get to the English national team, they're actually quite good with the first three shots, actually. So in a way, they're like a bit like the Indonesian style. You know, they're quite good. They generally don't hit so hard, but they do a lot of like, they drop one and then they smash one. Then they do like a slice smash or something like that. So they tend to like to, yeah, they tend to like to change the rhythm quite a lot. Whilst then at that level, Malaysian players, they're much more explosive, I suppose. So yeah, there's a huge difference actually.
Yeah, that's actually quite interesting to say, because I haven't really been exposed to county level players in England. So when you said that they smash more than they drop, it's actually surprising, because yeah, when you get to the national level, the English and the Europeans in general are very good at slice, half smash and everything before going full smash, whereas the Asians are usually more full smash straight away. So it's interesting that the county level is a little bit opposite there.
Yeah, actually, if you realize Malaysian players, like you notice that most, even the national players as well, they like to do a lot of placement shots first before really going out full smashing. For Malaysian players, not really for other, I can't really speak for other Asian countries, but I would say Malaysia, the general Malaysian style is like that, to play more control first and then only attack full out when there's a chance.
Except if you go Vishen.
Yeah, if you go Vishen, you're like, everything's 1.5 times speed.
Yeah.
And you jump 2 meters into the air as well. Yeah, cool. So Leon, you talked about your progression, I guess, through the different levels in Malaysia and the UK. And then you briefly touched on you mentioning that you were relatively competent when it comes to men's doubles. But I didn't really hear much about your men's singles kind of career or progression or development. Was there a moment in time when you started at 7 to 8 years old, you know, was it 2-3 years later that you decided, okay, I'm going to go men's doubles, or was it always men's doubles for you?
Okay, so this is something I wrestled with since I was young, because in comparison to my peers, ever since I was young, when it came to like running, like an endurance, I was always like a bit much more, I would say not much more, but I would say quite a bit weaker than my peers actually. But so it was, of course, we were all playing singles until we were into our late teens, right? And then I was still competing. And then I actually realized that, oh, I actually did better in men's doubles than I did in men's singles, because men's singles definitely you have to be very good in the endurance side, and you got to be quite light on your feet. And of course, I think in men's singles as well, your control has to be very good. And so I would say that in comparison to my peers, I actually lack a couple of these aspects to be good in men's singles actually. So of course, I would say that being an athlete, like that genetics part does play a role. Of course, then if you're very serious about your sport, then you work hard to overcome those weaknesses so that you can compensate, right? But for me, my strength was always, I was always complimented for my smash, actually, and my overall explosiveness, so to speak, which I suppose is more suited to men's doubles than it is to men's singles. Whereas men's singles is a lot of running, more emphasis on endurance and good control, you know, don't really need a strong smash to be good in men's singles. So yeah, I think that was sort of the path that sort of directed me to play more men's doubles. And competitively as well, I had better results in men's doubles. So that's probably the reason why. But it's interesting now, because now that now that my physicality is a bit more stronger as well, I am like training and playing singles a bit more, because I think there's also singles is a very different game, but I think it's a very beautiful game and it can be very elegant as well. So yeah.
Now, just a quick word from our sponsors.
The Badminton Podcast is brought to you by Volant. Volant was first born out of our frustration with the confusing, bright, and unsightly clothes and equipment that we saw in the badminton world. But now, it's so much more than that. Our mission is to accelerate the growth of badminton by providing players with products that enhance their love for the sport. All in all, it's high quality gear that makes you look and feel great on and off the court. So make sure you check us out at volantbadminton.com and follow us on our socials at volantbadminton.
And then in terms of your badminton career and what you've been able to do in badminton, how do you feel that badminton has affected the other aspects of your life? So whether that be your business or investing or study, like what has badminton taught you or shown you that you can adapt and use in to be successful in the other aspects of your life?
Right. Okay. So in the beginning of the bio, you guys mentioned briefly in the introduction that that I resonate with certain types of philosophies that actually integrate dichotomies together. So when I mean dichotomies, then it's basically like you got that really traditional symbol of like yin and yang and the Taoist symbol. So I've been quite inquisitive since I was young. And so that's why I studied philosophy from the A-level, pre-college, pre-university level to above. So you guys mentioned that in the introduction. And basically what Plato is talking about is that people who focus too much into one extreme, they become too crude and too savage. But if you go to the other side of the spectrum and you focus too much on the extreme, then you become too effeminate. You become too one-sided, right? And so, okay, so we start with this in the backdrop, right? So then I've always resonated with this sort of philosophies. And I think why I still regard badminton as extremely important in my life, even though that I no longer play competitively so much, is that you have on one side badminton, a sport that actually focuses a lot on your senses, your body, your physicality, right? And then on one side, you have all the other things, right? Maybe the business, maybe philosophy, all these things that sort of develop the mind. But badminton, but you see, these two things, they at face value, they seem quite antithetical, right? They seem like two extreme ends that can't be related to each other, right? So another thing about philosophy as well is that I'm also very interested in Bruce Lee's philosophy and how that's applied to my sport. And Bruce Lee's philosophy talks about how you integrate two extremes together. So there's one point that he was talking about, what is the ideal, right? How do you find balance, right? He also used the word integration as well. And so Bruce Lee, if you watch some of his interviews, he watched this natural unnaturalness or unnatural naturalness, right? He talked about trying to find a balance between instinct, natural instinct, and control. So if you have too much instinct, right, then you lack structure, right? You become very, he used the word unscientific. But let's say if you have too much control, then suddenly you become a mechanical man. You become like a robot. But if you marry those two together and you synthesize those two things, then you become a totally different monster, so to speak, you know? And that's where someone can find growth, right? So of course, Bruce Lee and even Plato as well, they're talking about very similar concepts, right? Marrying two extremes together. And it's also, I suppose it's also interesting that both of these philosophies, they came out at a similar time. I think it was maybe like 300 or 400 BC for Lao Tzu and maybe like 400-500 BC for Plato. So on a similar time. So I think that a lot of people, I think human beings in general do know this intuitively, that it is when you find balance in between one extreme that you find growth, right? Whereas if you're too much on one side, then you become too much of a lopsided character, you know, and no one wants to be a lopsided character if they realize it or not. So why badminton is because I think this is like, I think investing or doing business, managing my family business and badminton as well, it helps to ground me, I think. And to have two or three different pursuits in life, I think that really helps a lot with someone's personal growth. And also very interested in personal growth as well. So I think that's why when I do coach my students, I don't see myself as just a badminton coach. I see myself as a little bit of a life coach and a badminton coach as well. Because that's when, like, at that age, right, when you're like 4, 5, or 10, or 12, kids are just like sponges. They're just pretty much empty cups to be molded, right? They're just clay to be molded. So it's important that I think coaches at that level, they actually contribute to the children's character development as well as their game development as well. And of course, I think you guys have coaches when you were young as well. There are some things like that your coaches have told you that you remember forever, right? So yeah, and I think because your question is so broad, right? So I gotta have to draw the backdrop first and then sort of like try to answer the question as I hone in. So yes, that's why I think sports, including badminton, is important for everyone. It helps to ground you no matter who you are, right? And I think likewise as well, like I don't also believe that if one is like, one is defined by their occupation, right? Like if you are, for example, I don't know, a business analyst or you're a teacher, you're not just a teacher, you're not a business analyst. You know, you are all those things that you're passionate in and you're all those things that you do, right? So yeah, so that, and I think that applies to my outlook in life. I always try to integrate things together and try to find balance. And I think this sort of philosophies, a lot of people know intuitively. And I do believe that it should be permeated more to society, because I feel like we also tend to live in a society that reinforces polarizing ideas. Sometimes I do think the middle path is often the best path to go down. I hope that answers your question.
It definitely does. And it's good to have that backdrop as well and your perspective on how you approach life, and not just, I guess my question perhaps was broad because it is asking, you know, why. What has badminton taught you? But in reality, it's, you know, badminton is one part of, or one cog in the system of, that is Leon. And there are so many different aspects as part of Leon as well, whether that be, you know, your philosophy or investing. I mean, all those other parts that on their own, they may not seem related, like you said, but they all sort of intertwine and impact the different parts of your life. I think you said something about Bruce Lee earlier, but the only thing I remember from Bruce Lee is actually what he said, like, be like water, my friend.
Yes. Yes. So actually what Bruce Lee is trying to say is that we, as human beings, we should be very versatile, right? We should learn to read the situation rather than follow rigid structures or rigid formulas or rigid styles in order to address a certain problem, right? So, let me give it for example, right? When we learn badminton, we have multi-shuttle drills. Okay, maybe for singles, you have smash kill. Then maybe you have a play net, then you do a smash. No, that sort of thing. Well, maybe doubles, you just do the four corners at the back court and the four corners in front. You know, so this is only just blueprints of how one is able to play on the court, right? But if you think it, if you sort of go up a higher abstract level, right, you're actually teaching the person how to express themselves on the court, because everyone has a different style. So even though you learn the multi-shuttle drills, you're only learning a fixed routine, right? The same way a martial artist practices his forms with the wooden dummy, right? That's one way of practicing. But when you fight with someone, the difference between the wooden dummy and the person is that the person will fight back, right? So you are engaging with a totally different human being. Likewise, you are a human being, not a complete robot as well. So what's interesting about Bruce's philosophy is can be well applied to badminton as well, because training is just a blueprint. It can only give you the language, right? It can only teach you how to construct a sentence. The same way when you actually play a game against someone, you have all these ways of playing against someone else's clear, for example, right? You can play another clear. You can play a drop, a cross drop. You can play a smash, slice smash, whatever it is. But that's up to you, right? That is how, what you're comfortable with. So that's what Bruce Lee means by be water, my friend. So being water is like being true to yourself, right? And being true to the situation that you're trying to address. So because he's also famous for saying one other thing as well, and that's it's very difficult to express yourself honestly, right? It's, how did he say it? I think he said something like, in order to express oneself honestly, it's very hard to do, right? But that's something like, actually what resonated me the most in badminton, because sometimes like we watch other players play, like the famous players, or we follow the drills that we learn on court, or we follow the advice of the coach. But in the end of the day, everyone has their own style, right, that they're comfortable with. No matter how many million videos you watch of Lin Dan or Lee Chong Wei, right, you will definitely not be able to play the same shots exactly in the same sequence, or choose exactly the same shot as Lin Dan, Lee Chong Wei would have. And that's what I think about Bruce Lee, right? He's trying to teach you to train so that you can understand yourself better. Yeah, and then when you understand yourself better and you learn and you master all the basics, right, the same way you master a language, and then when you go on court, you play a game that is true to yourself, the game that you're comfortable with, the game that suits your temperament in a way. Because if you realize a lot of players, they play, you know, the playing style is actually a reflection of their character as well in some ways. Yeah, that's what I think about.
I don't want to make this a complete Bruce Lee quote off.
I feel like it's heading that way, Jeff.
But the one that I remember, the one that resonated with me, we don't have to go into this one, but I just want to say it just because we're on Bruce Lee, is he said that, "I don't fear the man who has practiced 10,000 kicks one time. I fear the man who practiced one kick 10,000 times."
Yeah.
That's a good one for me. Sharpen the knife, sharpen the blade. Anyway, let's move on so we don't guess go all into Bruce Lee. So you are a partner and coach at JS Badminton Academy. So we'd love to hear what made you decide to start your own badminton academy.
I think it was one of the ways where I felt that I realized that I was quite passionate about. I'm quite passionate about people's development. And I think, I suppose, like in the working world, right, that sort of aspect of your life becomes a little bit neglected. You know, whenever someone becomes busy, they neglect their health, and they neglect their overall physical well-being, right? And so I remember, because before I started my academy, I was always an assistant coach for about 3 or 4 years. And that was when I sort of realized, oh, I actually really enjoy like contributing to someone's development. And so that was sort of really kept me coming back as an assistant coach, right? Because of course I had my day job in the family business as well, but all my free time during the weekends, I was also being an assistant coach in one of my friend's academy. So it was after the pandemic where things started to reopen again. Then my friend came forward to me like, oh, you know, like maybe we could collaborate, and then we could start an academy in PJ. So that's where I coach. I coach in a badminton hall called Forum 19 in PJ. And that was literally what sparked my interest in opening my badminton academy. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. And how has it been going since you were talking about the pandemic is sort of kickstarted this journey? Like, how has it been going since then?
Good. I think since the pandemic, a lot of people want to come back. They want to play, they want to train. And I think over the pandemic as well, I think it really helped because there was the Tokyo Olympics, right? And then after that, there was so many tournaments after the Tokyo Olympics, right? And so I think the interest for badminton has rebounded very strongly. And I was also starting to realize as well that a lot of my students who have been with me for a while now, when they see their game improve, right, then they're much more confident on court. And that actually relates back to their mental well-being as well. Their overall, and it contributes to their overall well-being. So I think when you train, it's not just because you train because you want to become a certain level of player or you want to reach state level, or you want to reach, you know, a certain kind of level, but rather that if you train, you get better, then you become more confident on court, and then you win more games, right? And that sort of confidence and assertiveness trickles down to the rest of their lives. And I feel, yeah, it's quite a fulfilling process, actually.
Yeah. What you just said reminds me of, I don't know if you've read a book called Outliers.
Yeah, I've read the book.
But one of the first chapters is just about when they took like some of the top ice hockey players in the league and they figured out which months they were born in. The vast majority of them were born like I think April or before, because the age cutoff each year was December each year or December 31 each year. So that just meant that they were a bit older than everyone who was born in the rest of the year. And because of that, because they're a little bit bigger, they're a little bit stronger, they're probably maybe mentally developed a little bit more. So then they can play better, perform better. And then because of that, they get more opportunities. And because they get more opportunities, they get to improve faster, et cetera. Yeah. So that kind of reminded me of that when you said that, yeah, when you coach and when someone gets better, it's not just that they're getting better, right? It's that they feel they're getting better, the confidence builds. And then because the confidence builds, then that allows you to build more on top of that.
Exactly. Yeah, it compounds, right? So it's actually like a loop. You guys see it. So like, it's all about getting the loop started, right? And sometimes a person can be at the right place at the right time, right? So that helps a lot as well. But I think trying to raise an athlete is definitely more of a dedication for the parents than the kid, right? Because when you're a kid, you just do what your parents ask, more or less, right? So yeah. And definitely, yes, that compounding aspect as well is actually also relates to the investing part, because if you realize when it comes to sport and it comes to like money or anything mathematical, right, these things compound. It's actually a phenomenon that not just happens in numbers, but it also happens in sport as well.
Yeah. Oh, compounding is one of the greatest forces of nature, right?
Yes.
And so, Bill, perhaps we'll move on from badminton and hopefully we can switch gears into investing a bit later as well. We'll talk a bit more about philosophy. Would really love to get your opinion, Leon, especially if listeners are listening to this podcast, right, and haven't really delved into philosophy. And of course, from our conversation so far, it seems like philosophy or Plato's quote has had a huge impact on your approach to life and approach to badminton. So it would be great if you could share, if I were as a listener and I, you know, really wanted to get started learning about philosophers, learning about Plato, maybe learning about Bruce Lee, where would you begin?
Okay, so there's one thing I have to talk about philosophy as well, like as a disclaimer, right? So I think philosophy can be very informative when you are reading philosophy in order to apply principles in your life. But there are certain corners in philosophy as well that sort of troubles oneself with, like the restlessness of problems. So because philosophy, there are many branches, right? So I think when it comes to starting and beginning philosophy, try not to read so much into certain branches like phenomenology, right? And maybe start to read something that's a bit more applicable to your life. So you have certain branches of philosophy like existentialism and phenomenology. So phenomenology sort of discusses about the significance of objects in a person's life, right? So I think it's like, for example, related to interior design and architecture, something like that. So that is more, that relates a bit more to aesthetics. It also depends what you're interested in, right? If you're interested, for example, like there's some people who are interested in metaphysics. So metaphysics is basically the investigation into very fundamental questions in life, right? Does time exist? Does God exist? then you probably read something about philosophy or religion, for example, right? That talks about the sort of things. You have many, many arguments, right? Some people, they have this problem of evil argument, etc. So just to point a few things out if you're interested, if your listeners are interested in this sort of branch of philosophy. So in philosophy and religion, people talk about intelligent design, creationism, and then you have counter arguments, for example, like the problem of evil. For example, like the very classic question, right? Like, if God is so loving, then how can he allow evil to permeate throughout the world, for example? These are the sort of questions that philosophy and religion addresses. And then perhaps you have, there's a branch as well called ethics as well that talks about how someone should behave in the world. So it really depends. It really depends on what you're interested in. And then you sort of start from there. Yeah. But I suppose in sport, I think Bruce Lee is a great place to start, actually, in sport. And I think Bruce Lee can be very, very, very inspiring as well.
Yeah, I think philosophy is probably a word that you would hear it and people would think, oh, well, that's cool, but it seems so complex because there's so many things happening. There's so many different theories. Like you said, you'd have to look for something that you're interested in order to find the answer to the question that you're asking. And everyone's question will be different. So, Leon, my question for you is, in terms of the questions you were asking when you started your philosophy journey, and even now, like, what were the key questions that were driving you to learn more about philosophy?
Want to know Leon's answer? That's what's coming up in part two of our conversation with him. So make sure you tune in there. That's it for now. So from Jeff and I at the Badminton Podcast, thanks for listening and get excited for the next one.